I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Drive just about anywhere in downtown Kansas City, and you're bound to run into construction. From renovations to new buildings and farewells to landmark businesses, the city is literally buzzing with development and development news. Today, Kevin Collison brings us the latest on Kansas City's ever-changing look. Then, a conversation from earlier this year on how young women can become active in the social and political causes they care about. We get advice on first steps and the big and small ways that women can contribute to the revolution. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. New developments in downtown Kansas City have become a frequent subject on this show. That's because so much is going on down there these days. Kevin Collison is back with us to discuss all the latest happenings, which include a new bookstore, another new hotel, some historic rehab in the Jazz District, and a new purpose for the old Kansas City Star Building, where Kevin and I toiled for so many years. These days, Kevin Collison is the editor-in-chief of City Scene KC, an online news site devoted to coverage of the greater downtown area. You can find it at cityscenekc.com. Kevin, it's always good to have you here. Welcome back.
Good morning, Steve. Great to be here.
Well, downtown keeps humming. Has the rebuilding and the repurposing of downtown Kansas City slowed at all, or is it still full speed ahead?
I would say on many levels, it's still full speed ahead. We're still seeing a lot of residential development. We're seeing, as you mentioned, a huge boom in a hotel activity for a variety of reasons, which I wish I could tell you, but I don't really know.
It's like 15 new hotels in the last few years, the newspaper said today.
Several opening up. There's several in the pipeline, and that's not even discounting the 800-room Lowe's Convention Hotel that's well under construction now over near Bartle Hall.
Is there a chance we're getting overbuilt when it comes to hotels?
I think the banks will decide that.
Of course.
Yeah, I don't really know if all these projects are going to move forward, but there certainly, there are a lot that are just coming online right now. I just drove by what's going to be called the Indigo Hotel over on Grand near 20th Street. They are putting up the sign above their door, so they're getting ready to open. The Crossroads Hotel, which is another boutique historic preservation project, is opening up in mid-October in the Crossroads District. We've got, there's still plans out there for this Federal Reserve Bank downtown to be converted into an Embassy Suites. I did a story the other day about Hyatt wants to build a place over on Broadway near 8th Street. And one of the more controversial proposals that came up within the past month or so, Drury Inn wants to tear down the old Board of Ed building over on McGee,
right,
near City Hall and County Hall, and put a Drury Inn Hotel in that space. So it's amazing. I mean,
than a dozen hotels being planned in recent
at
years,
least,
and there could
least.
Be a new tour of Kansas City involving hopping from hotel to hotel.
I guess, yeah, you and I know? can have long, nice staycations for the next 10 years and never get bored. But what's still interesting, though, and actually next month, I'm going to be moderating a panel discussion that the Downtown Council's putting on about office use, and we're still... Downtown is really got a lot of great stuff going on, and we can talk a little bit about some of the new retail that's opened up too. But we're still not seeing a great deal of office activity, which has some people perplexed because downtown is so much more congenial environment these days. There's so many more services and amenities, and yet we're not seeing the private sector following the example of some of this other activity and bringing more offices downtown.
So why would that be?
I really wish I could tell you. That's one of the reasons we're going to have this panel discussion.
Right.
There's this school of thought out there that many people adhere to, that companies that want to attract younger, more creative, more urban-oriented workers want to be downtown. We're seeing some good activity in a couple of buildings in the Crossroads area. Corrigan Station, which is a rehab that opened about a year and a half ago, is fully leased. But, we still are seeing a lot of these companies building or occupying office space along that 435 corridor in southern Johnson County, which, you know, is not an urban environment at all as far as being able to walk out the door and get someplace. So, you know, this is one of these discussions that we're going to have with this panel discussion. And hopefully, you know, we're going to see, you know, people starting to respond to the fact that downtown is definitely a much, much nicer environment than it was 15, 20 years ago when maybe some of these executives were last there.
Kevin Collison of City Scene KC is my guest. We're talking about downtown Kansas City and the area, the region down there, development, new development there. You get a sense that this debate over tax incentives connected to the downtown still hasn't waned, despite the success the downtown district has enjoyed. In fact, a new study about Kansas City's use of tax incentives came out recently saying what?
Well, it was covered a 10-year period that I think ended in 2015, and it basically concluded, which is not shocking, but it just confirms that most of the incentives the city's been using, particularly property tax abatements and tax increment financing, have been focused on projects in the greater downtown area. And it did find that there was not a real matchup between blight calls and where investment was going on. And, you know, obviously
the idea that TIF, tax increment financing, is supposed to address blight. That's one
of
the purposes.
Yeah, but I mean, everybody forgets it's not like magic dust that you throw out there and suddenly developers go there. I mean, you have to have a project that makes sense for the incentives to actually help to get done. And there are some really positive things coming along on Troost Corridor. I just was yesterday at 24th and Troost, and they had a groundbreaking for a new La Quinta Hotel there. And it's
That's interesting. A new hotel on Troost.
24th
That'll
and Troost.
That'll surprise people, too.
Well, yeah. I mean, there's a wonderful story going on right now on Troost Corridor, because it's only a block away from where UMKC built a really nice housing complex for students. You just go a couple of blocks further. You've got a lot of investment going on. The old Wonder Bread Bakery building has been completely renovated at around 27th and Troost. There's a new apartment project going up at 27th and Troost. Armour and Troost may be the location where Mac Properties wants to do a nice big residential development. And, you know, so you're really seeing some great traction. So the theory that you build from inside out, where downtown gets strong, you got a ripple, goes out to Troost, that starts improving, and people hope to keep pushing that east. But getting back to that study you mentioned, which was that period between roughly 05 and 2015, not surprisingly, it showed most of the city's incentive programs have been going towards helping downtown projects. And we got to remember was the key era when things were finally starting to get going to revitalize downtown.
Okay, our number 816-235-2888 to talk to Kevin Collison about recent development news in the downtown region of Kansas City. Let's go to some calls now. Elizabeth from downtown Kansas City, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you so much for taking my call,
you
Steve.
Bet.
Hi, Kevin. It's Elizabeth Gooden from Gooden Jewelers. How are you, dude?
I'm good. Good. How are you?
Well, I'm calling because, you know, I'm calling about the fate of the beloved Mark Twain Tower building. I'm sorry that's not occupied right now. And also, I wanted to know if the rumor of Hy-Vee going downtown where Bob Jones is true. So
wow.
I'll take my answers off the air, and thank you. I hope that's good gossip.
Well, I wish I could give you an answer.
Rumor of Hy-Vee in the Bob Jones store. Wow.
I can't imagine a Hy-Vee going into Jones store.
Off
I'm sorry, mind. Elizabeth. I've not heard that one at all. But I'll follow up and try to find out more. I'd love to write a story if it's got any legs to it. The Mark Twain Project, you know, that's been a tough sell. There was a real hard look at that.
And where is the Mark Twain?
Well, the Mark Twain's on Baltimore at about 10th Street, like that.
Yeah, sounds right.
It's across from where they renovated the old Brookfield building into another Hotel Indigo. Don't ask me why we've got two Hotel Indigos downtown, but we do. I think the big nut to crack there, it's where the old Kansas City Athletic Club is. It's where the Playboy Club used to be way back in the day. You know, they're having a hard time figuring out how to get parking for that facility. You know, the streetcar has been an incredible amenity. It's just done so much to jazz up downtown. But a lot of these big projects still need to have some kind of a parking. There was a plan that came out 5 years ago or so where they were kicking around the idea of using the lower floors of the Mark Twain as parking, which I don't think many people really like that idea.
Right.
So there was a hard look at that, and it just didn't come through. So it's still a great old building. I have a strong hunch that sooner or later somebody's going to find a way to make that work. But right now it's one of the few big historic buildings downtown that still hasn't found a new use.
That's interesting. The new owner of the Kansas City Star property has announced a $95 million redevelopment plan. Is this hard for you to see given the years you spent in that building? And I guess
well,
I did too.
The years you and I spent in that building, the interior of it was pretty cut up with all kinds of old false ceilings and corridors that went nowhere and all the rest. What Vince Bryant, he bought the building from McClatchy, the owner of the Star, and that deal closed last fall. And the Star newsroom and all the other employees have now finally moved out to the printing pavilion.
Yeah.
And so that building is now totally in Vince's hands. He came before the city a few weeks ago with his redevelopment plan, which basically calls for renovating the old historic building that you and I used to work in, preserving many of the old historic fixtures that some of them were buried when you and I were there because they were behind these walls and ceilings. And he wants to use it as office space, as a tech center. He's got a bar and rec sand volleyball operation that wants to go into one corner. Hmm. But what's also fascinating is he wants to redevelop the south part of that property where that right along 18th Street, he wants to put a food pavilion in there. He wants to build an underground garage to serve it.
Wow.
So it's pretty ambitious stuff. It got a lot of people excited when I wrote about it for City Scene. And, you know, there's still a long ways to go between getting a plan out there and asking for city incentive help and actually getting it done. But he was behind, along with Copic and Brooks, the renovation of the Corrigan Station building, which has turned into a real success. But what's unbelievable, Steve, is the Star building that you and I used to work in is twice as big in square footage as the Corrigan Station building, which is this 10-story building, which is a pretty impressive structure on the corner of, like, I think, 18th and Walnut.
Wow. Well, and there's also talk about a new school opening up downtown, too. Tell us a little bit about that building and its occupants and what's happening there.
Well, it actually opened up a week ago. It's the Crossroads Academy has one of the great feel-good stories about downtown. I mean, for years, people have always said, we really would love to get a school in our downtown. Well, about 5 years ago now, maybe a little less than that, a charter school called Crossroads Academy opened up in an old office building at 10th and Central for grade school kids. And the program has proven to be incredibly popular. They started with 190 kids. I think they're up to roughly 800 now. And as the kids have gotten older, they've opened up a middle school in one of the old mansions in Quality Hill. And now they took over the old Thayer building, which is on Broadway. And it had been used, which is a sad story, by DST as a training center. So it was in really great shape to be converted to a high school. And so they opened up Crossroads Academy Prep just last week with 190 kids, and they ultimately hope to have 600 students there. And the game plan at the end of the day is they want to have 1,300 students. So I can't think, between you and me, of any city of comparable size to Kansas City where you have a K-12 public school available to people living and working downtown.
You know, people might wonder about the drop-off and the pickup areas and parent parking. Is there room for all of that?
Oh, buddy, I don't – you know, those things are going to get sorted out. It is on Broadway, which is a busy street.
Right.
You know, where there's a will, there's a way. I think they'll figure it out.
The Charlotte Street Foundation has a new home at 16th and Broadway near the Denny's up there. You said on City Scene that it'll be a permanent place for the once nomadic arts group as long as the area is spared from redevelopment. What are the odds of that happening, considering everything else going on downtown?
Well, it's a performance space for Charlotte Street Foundation. They've still got a gallery as well, but they never had a permanent place. So Copac and Brooks owns that whole stretch of Broadway, roughly between the interstate ramp that comes off there. I'm not quite sure how far south it goes, but it's always been called the Denny's site because there's a Denny's restaurant there. And it's been kicked around for a long time as a major redevelopment site, and it was actually mentioned in a study a few years ago about a potential site for a UMKC arts campus.
Mm-hmm.
So the buzz is that it is in the running for this UMKC conservatory project, which has been kind of put out. The whole original deal fell apart. UMKC is now looking for an alternative site. They put out a request for information. They got some proposals. We don't know exactly, but we do know that Barney Ellis Plaza is being pitched, which had been also suggested in an earlier study. And the old Westport High School also is being pitched.
Wow.
And there is strong belief that that this Denny site. So, you know, who knows how long the UMKC process is going to take, whether they can meet the criteria of it. But for the time being, Charlotte Street has a place where they can put on experimental productions and other avant-garde artwork that needs, you know, a permanent home so people can actually rehearse.
You know, in a perfect world, that Denny's is such a high-profile business, and it's obviously right across the street from the Kauffman Center, which is, you know, this sterling establishment, and across the street you have this sort of neon yellow Denny's place. In a perfect world, would the city want to see that become something else?
Well, that's the whole development.
Right, yeah.
The Denny's would go, all those older buildings along there would go. But, you know, getting into the whole retail thing, I don't know if you wanted to go there, but you know, you mentioned the bookstore. Delaware Street in the River Market has just blossomed over the past couple of years into a really cool little cafe scene. Our Daily Nada, which is the bookstore you mentioned.
I really want to go check it out.
It's nice. They just opened up this week. They still haven't gotten their liquor license yet, but it's a couple of women, a couple of attorney buddies who decided to do this. And they are inspired by a place in Paris called Shakespeare and Company, which is a bookstore and cafe with sidewalk seating. And so they opened it up in one of those storefronts on Delaware between 3rd and 5th Street, which is just, in my mind, one of the prettiest historic streets in downtown Kansas City. All these nice old 19th century buildings, late 19th, the Pacific House where the Union Army had their headquarters during the Civil War, and the streetcar goes right down there. So if you want a really urbane, cosmopolitan little stretch of downtown, that's one of the nicest. So, but just up the street from them, these guys just opened up a place called Freestyle Poke, which is this Hawaiian food in a bowl. Next door, three guys opened up what they call Tribe, which features street food from all over the world, which personally is really excellent food. You got Artego Pizza. I think that's their name. If it's not, I'm sorry. I apologize. But it's a great little pizzeria. You got Key Coffee. You've got The Farmhouse, which has been there for a long time.
Right.
And so you got this really nice little scene. Oh, and Betty Ray's Ice Cream just opened up right next to where they parked a historic streetcar at the corner of 5th and Delaware.
So the River Market is really
well. The River Market in itself is just a great area town, but that Delaware Street, really, now you got half a dozen different food and beverage places and a bookstore, and hopefully there's a guy from Denver who bought a lot of those properties. His name's Craig Slauson, and he really has plans to really continue to encourage that to become a really nice pedestrian cafe, restaurant, beverage place for people to go to.
Moving over to the east side, a couple of historic rehab projects announced in the 18th and Vine area. What's happening there?
Well, God bless these guys. I mean, some of these developers, they see what you and I would think is just a total ruin and believe that there's potential for it. So there's the old Wheatley Provident, or Provident Wheatley, I can't remember. It's the old hospital.
Yes.
It's near 18th and Vine Jazz District. It was historically the African-American hospital in town before African-Americans were allowed to be treated, you know, when segregation ruled this city. And a couple of developers want to convert that into office space. And not far from there is the historic city street department and water department buildings. And these things look like they're something out of medieval times. I mean, they were built in the 1860s, so they've got to be some of the oldest buildings in the city. In fact, I think they were the first major public works buildings that the city of Kansas City built. They're built of limestone walls that are probably a foot and a half thick, and that's all that's there right now are the limestone walls. Mm-hmm. And these guys want to redevelop them, put roofs on, put windows in, all the rest of the stuff you need to make a building habitable, and also and use that for their own office space, and then try to get some other people to move in there. So it's a great reason why historic preservation tax credits are so important, because you know that's the only way they can afford to make these things happen.
But 18th and Vine still
18th.
You know.
Well, you know, I mean, you know, there's some streetscaping going in. I wish I could tell you more. I don't really know any new ads as far as retailers or activities there. But I know, as you know, the city has redoubled its effort to try to get that area so that it's viable. They want to get the museum, the jazz museum, in better operating condition. And there is lots of effort. The Kansas City Area Transportation Authority has a big chunk of property on 18th Street between the East Crossroads and 18th and Vine. So they're trying to make connections between the Crossroads area and the 18th and Vine area to kind of like bring everything together on that front.
And speaking, you mentioned the streetcar a little bit ago. The stop at 7th and Main is getting a big upgrade. What do you know about that?
They're putting a shelter in there. I'd never say it is a big upgrade. But on the other end of downtown, if I don't know if you want to talk about Bob Jones' shoes.
Well, you mentioned it.
This is kind of
a Hy-Vee, but do we know
the Hy-Vee. That's a new one. I had not heard that, but. Bob Jones Shoes, it's kind of ironic that, okay, here's a business that has hung in there since 1960. I mean, just imagine what downtown was like when Bob Jones opened up. And apparently it was just kind of this potpourri of all kinds of stuff they sold there. But, I mean, that's when all the big department stores were still downtown, tons of other retail. I mean, that's when downtown was still a bustling.
I bought a lot of shoes in that store.
Well, my mother would know about it in South Dakota. So this place had a great reputation. And so they hung in there and they really had become this regional shoe mecca. I mean, people from all over the metro and all over the area would come there to buy. And now they're closing. Now that downtown is really starting to get its mojo back, they're closing. But it's more because the guys that own it are older. They've decided they want to retire. Mm-hmm. I asked him, so why didn't anybody want to buy this business? And he said they wanted him to stick around and be their shoe buyer. And he said, I just wasn't into it. So they're closing their doors and their big sale, I guess, not that I'm going to be huckstering for Bob Jones Shoes, but they're going to have a retirement sale starting, I think, the first week in September.
Well, that's Kevin Collison again, editor-in-chief of City Scene KC. You can find it at cityscenekc.com. Kevin, thanks for the good update. I really appreciate it.
Always fun. Good to
see you.
Time
for a break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Getting young people to connect with their government and involved in the issues of the day is something I preach about every chance I get. A program we had earlier this year offered some great ways to get started, so we thought it was worth another listen. From March 2nd, here's my conversation with Emma Gray. So maybe you still have an election 2016 hangover and you're wondering how to get back in the game and stay engaged long term this time. Maybe you're a young adult or the parent of one watching national movements now being led by high school and college students, and you're inspired and wondering how a young person could jump into the fray for the first time. Emma Gray, the executive women's editor at HuffPost, has compiled a new book that strings together some ways to get involved, stay involved, and a whole lot more. That book, A Girl's Guide to Joining the Resistance, a feminist handbook on fighting for good. Emma Gray joins us now from NPR in New York. And Emma, thanks for taking the time.
Thanks for having me.
You know, you say in your introduction here that you'd often thought of writing a book, but about a host of other things. What finally made this one come together?
Well, I'm a journalist. I cover the intersection of gender and politics. And so I covered the 2016 presidential election. And I found myself on election night at the Javits Center, where the Clinton campaign was. And my team thought we would be writing a story about our nation electing its first woman president. And instead, obviously, we ended up writing a very different story. And I spent hours on the street interviewing a lot of very grief-stricken Clinton supporters who were full of anger and fear. And then a few months later, I covered the Women's March in D.C., and I got to see firsthand what it looks like when that fear and grief and anger is channeled into civic action. And that just was incredibly moving, and it made me want to explore this burgeoning resistance a little bit more and speak to the women who were leading it.
To what extent is that resistance, the resolve of that resistance, hanging tough, a year and some months into the Trump administration?
I wasn't sure if the energy would keep up. When I went out to cover the second round of women's marches, I wondered, will we see much smaller crowds? Will people be exhausted? And instead, I was in New York this year, and the crowds were massive. People were so energized. I interviewed at least a handful of people who hadn't marched the first time and were out there this year because of, the Me Too movement, Time's Up, the Larry Nassar case. I think there are a lot of things we're seeing that is kind of re-energizing this movement, and that energy is being channeled in different directions on different issues.
So what's the first step for a young person wanting to get involved here then, Emma? I mean, you write about about going to an LGBTQ rights march when you were a kid. But, you know, for some kids, they're not being raised in a politically active environment. So what does this girl do on day one there?
It can be incredibly overwhelming,
yes.
And I acknowledge that. And I think the most important thing to do is start small. Pick one thing that you feel passionately about, something that you think you can have the energy to, you know, run the marathon, not the sprint on. And then simply look at an organization that is working on that issue already, or an individual, and either send that person an email or go on that organization's website and ask them, I have X amount of time, I have X amount of money, what can I do to help you? What can I do to help the work that is already being done? The beauty here is that on pretty much every issue, you don't have to create something new. You just have to show up for the work other people are already doing.
And young women, young people in general are intimidated oftentimes to engage because why? It's complicated. They don't really fully understand the issue. They don't think they're smart enough. What goes into that calculus?
Young women in particular are a group that is taught to make themselves small, whose voices and opinions are so often dismissed. And yet, there is a long and beautiful history in this nation of young people of all genders being the driving force behind social movements. And so I wanted to be really clear that, you know, what we're seeing in Parkland right now is building off of the work that young people in communities of color have been doing around gun control for decades. We saw young people leading, you know, the women's liberation movement, Gloria Steinem as a young woman, like Diane Nash taking charge in the civil rights movement. So while young people are often dismissed and can feel belittled or overwhelmed, at the same time, they are building off of such a beautiful tradition of being the energizers of change.
One thing I've noticed as someone who's written about politics for many years for the newspaper here is this idea that, you know, these causes oftentimes require a long game. It's not going to happen in a week or 3 days. You're looking at months and maybe even years of effort, and that can be a little daunting sometimes.
Absolutely. And that's why it's so important to take those small steps. You don't have to change the world overnight. Just show up and chip away at what you can. Maybe that's, you know, lobbying your school board to expand their education on consent in the sex ed curriculum. Maybe that's finding a city council candidate that you really support and going out and canvassing for them a couple of times. We don't need to always create a new movement and change things, you know, in a day. It's about doing what you can with the tools that you have in front of you.
Mm-hmm. If some of the young folks listening have become engaged recently and want to share their experiences, 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Or if you're a parent, how do you convince your teen or young adult to become involved in civic, social, or political movements? Again, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. What if you are a parent and you're wanting to get your child more involved, but you're new to this whole thing too? What do you advise them about how to get their kids engaged?
Just start having conversations. Bring up, again, one thing that you feel passionately about with your child and try to engage them. And chances are, you know, teenagers are incredibly, incredibly smart and powerful. They have probably already thought about a lot of these things. They're probably having those conversations with their peers at high school, or they're reading the news. They're on Twitter. So again, start small, start with one thing, and ask a genuine question. Ask your child what they think about something, or suggest, let's go out and canvass together, or why don't you pick a friend and do X action with them. Create, you know, make a suggestion that feels manageable and not so overwhelming and not like you are forcing something on your teen.
Emma Gray's new book, A Girl's Guide to Joining the Resistance, a feminist handbook on fighting for good. We know most white women especially voted for Trump. Is there something in here for conservative young women wanting to become more actively engaged?
Obviously, I did write the book with women on the left in mind specifically, but I think a lot of the lessons in there hold for all people across the political spectrum. There is a value in owning your narrative and using your story to speak to other people. I have a section in there encouraging people to engage people in their communities, in their families, people that they go to school with, and have the difficult conversations. Speak to people that you might disagree with. Not because you're necessarily going in there guns blazing to change their mind, but because we need to create empathy and we need to create understanding. So that all holds for conservative women as well. And I think a healthy political system is one where all of our voices are engaged in it.
We just had a Kansas State lawmaker on in our first half, Representative Patty Markley from Overland Park, and she was making the point that when it comes to getting women engaged, you've got to ask once, then ask again, then ask a third and fourth times before sometimes you can pull the thing off.
Women often are taught, again, that their experiences and that their expertise isn't quite as valid. And that's where women need to kind of be asked. And I'm hoping that this book serves as that ask for young women. But I'm very heartened to see that, you know, in the weeks after the presidential election, a lot of organizations like Emily's List, She Should Run, reported record numbers of women stepping up and saying, I'm interested in being involved. I'm interested in running for office. And that momentum has actually kept up until now. It is kept steady, and it's the highest levels of interest they've ever seen. And we're starting to see those women actually run now. And we're seeing that engagement both on the left and on the right as well. And I find that to be incredibly heartening.
What's holding women back from getting more involved in politics? Emma Gray's new book, A Girl's Guide to Joining the Resistance, A Feminist Handbook on Fighting for Good. Your book is interesting. It's interspersed with these almost mini history lessons, you know, stories about the shirtwaist workers' strike at the turn of the century, the march at Selma back in the 60s, the Women's National Liberation Conference in the 70s. What's the value in including these historical elements in a present-day guide?
I think there's something very comforting in knowing you're not entering any fight alone. You have this wave of women who have come before you, who have gotten us, you know, a little closer perhaps to a goal. And when you are, quote, joining the resistance, you are actually just building off of their work. I also think that there's something incredibly inspiring about seeing that young women have always led this charge and that they have been able to create change. You see with the anecdote that I included at the beginning of the book about Clara Lemlich, a 23-year-old shirtwaist maker who really set off this strike that 20 to 40,000 shirtwaist makers ended up joining. And it really made an impact on labor regulations for that industry. So you can create change because, hey, it's already been done. So if they could do it, you know, we can do it today. We have Twitter. We have Instagram. It's even easier to get your message across now.
Yeah, the new name out in the universe there is Emma Gonzalez, a student from Parkland, Florida, who has quickly become a leader on gun control as part of the Never Again movement. What do you make of what kind of impact she's had?
It's incredible to watch. You know, I wrote this book, obviously, far before Parkland happened, and then as it's coming out, we are seeing the lessons that I was trying to get across play out in real time. Emma Gonzalez has become sort of a figurehead for this current moment, but there are so many students who are organizing around her and with her, who are creating real change and finally, you know, breaking through the noise and really wresting the conversation away from adults and forcing the country to listen to them. And it's incredible. And we're seeing the poll numbers actually shift in greater favor for common sense gun regulations. And we have to hand it to these teens. In part, it is because of them.
What is it about young people and young women in particular that can make them such a powerful force?
I think they have an audacity. I mean, first of all, young people are the ones who are going to inherit the future that we create today. There is almost the most at stake for them. And also, they're not beaten down by bureaucracy. They haven't seen things not work out so many times that they're just like, oh, well, you know, we're done. This is it. This is how it is. And I can't change it. They have the imagination and the bravery, I think, to imagine that the future could be better and that they could demand better.
You know, these stories you tell in the book, these mini history lessons that I referred to, what's one of your favorite stories, or maybe one who's been left out of most high school or college history classes that you think should be emphasized again?
Well, Clara Lemlich, who I mentioned before, is my personal favorite. Huh. But I also think, you know, Sylvia Rivera, who helped set off the Stonewall Riot, is incredibly interesting. Angela Grimke, who was one of a Quaker sister, who, you know, testified on abolition. I think that is an incredible example of a white woman being an ally so early to women of color. Mm-hmm. There are so many stories that we don't hear in our social studies classes that should be included.
You know, in the chapter, How to Stop Watching Netflix, you encourage people to actually, this is interesting to me, you want them to steer clear from Twitter and Facebook and to start having tough conversations with people you might disagree with offline. You know, in an age when young people are constantly on social media, why take these conversations away from the internet?
We absolutely need both. That is not to say that conversations that happen on the internet aren't important. There are so many people that you can reach online that you can't reach one-to-one. But we know that real change and real understanding often is a lot harder to reach when you are fighting with someone in your Facebook comments than when you sit down, you're looking someone in the eye, and you are using your story and creating a real connection between that person. And often, I think these conversations are best received when the people who are speaking to each other already have a connection. You know, are you talking to your aunt? Are you talking to your friend from high school? It's a lot easier to reach common ground when you are having that face-to-face conversation with someone who already sort of knows you than yelling at a stranger online.
And people want to know a lot of times, Emma, what's your advice for starting these conversations? I think that's something that people of all ages sort of want to figure out. How do you get the thing going?
First, you need to have both parties agree to actually engage in a dialogue. You can't have a conversation with someone who doesn't want to have that conversation with you. So I will say that first. And also, I think it's good to set up kind of ground rules when you have these conversations. The Women's March organization has a really great toolkit, what they call for daring discussions, and they lay out exactly how you can go through and have those conversations. So I would recommend going to their website and looking up daring discussions, and they give really great practical advice on how to kick off a dialogue that can actually be productive.
Ultimately, you suggest that that advocacy has to come from the heart. And in many cases, that includes storytelling. What are you talking about there?
So that chapter actually wasn't even in my original outline for this book, which is so funny because now I find it to be such an important one. When I went out there and started interviewing all of these women, who, you know, political figures, grassroots activists, almost every single person brought up the power of storytelling. And what they meant by that is that making, you know, the political personal in a very overt way. When you are talking about legislation or you're talking about a political cause and you explain, this is the experience that I had and this is why I care so much about this, it's easier to connect to. And I bring up, you know, the abortion rights movement as a great example of this, where, you know, people are complicating the narrative. Campaigns like the 1 in 3 campaign are encouraging women to come out and share their stories of their experiences with that medical procedure. And then, of course, we're seeing this play out in real time with the Me Too movement, mm-hmm. which is literally a national movement built on storytelling. And when one woman steps up and says, Me Too, and this is my story, she opens up the space for other women and men to tell their stories.
You know, some of the tactics that you recommend in the book are reminiscent of actions that, you know, social justice movements used to use way back in the day in the 60s and 70s. I'm talking about things like conscious raising groups. What do these groups really do?
The groups really just create a space for people to engage in discussion and reach a consensus of, oh, this is why this thing matters. And what I was referencing with the consciousness raising was that after the election, a very close friend of mine invited a group of women over to her apartment and just to sit and talk. And it created this incredible energy. And my friends ended up a few months later raising $15,000 for the last abortion clinic in Kentucky. And then a few months later, raising almost the same amount of money for an organization that supports immigrants in Arizona. And there is such power, again, in that storytelling, in that one-to-one or group in-person dialogue. And then you can create the energy that you need to actually go out and take action as a group after. And there's something that feels a lot more manageable about having other people next to you when you're going out and trying to create change than just trying to do everything by yourself.
You know, over the years, one of the big complaints about women in politics is that women, statistically speaking, didn't donate as much money as men did to various political candidates and causes. Now, there are various reasons for that, but is that beginning to change?
I actually am not familiar with statistics on that, but we do know that, you know, middle-aged women, for example, are the group that is most likely to be showing up and calling their representatives. So we know that women are getting engaged in these causes at higher and higher rates, and I would assume that that also includes donations.
Hmm. You know, here in Kansas City, it can be a little daunting, I think, to think that you can become an influencer on a national level. How do you recommend that young women stay involved from a distance when we're far away from Washington, for example, out here in the heartland?
There is a lot of pressure to make a splash with whatever you do, especially yes. in the social media age. And it's so important for young women to remember that you do not need to change the world overnight. Start local, start small, do what you can. Again, as I said, find something that's going on right in your own community. You don't necessarily need to address the politics that are going on in Washington directly, but those politics are really impacted by the state level and the local level. So start there.
I was going to say, a lot of folks automatically assume that if they can't have an impact like Emma Gonzalez is having, what's the point?
Right. And that is self-defeating because you might not, you know, get on CNN, but you might change one or two or five people's day. If you are changing your county's curriculum on a subject, that is going to change the way that essentially a generation of students are educated. That has a massive impact, even if it doesn't, you know, land you on the news.
Jen has tweeted us this: my 9-year-old is more civically aware than many adults. It's often a family matter, she suggests, because kids are taught political discussions are rude. And I've heard that before, too. And that always fascinates me. Like, why would anyone assume that has to be the case? Because politics is, in theory, a contact sport, right?
Absolutely. And there is something really negative about the perception that, oh, to bring up politics is taboo, and we don't talk about that, and you shouldn't talk about that on a date. You shouldn't talk about that with your friends. You shouldn't talk about that at the Thanksgiving dinner table. I say, talk about it whenever you want. This is what's going on.
Yeah.
That we're in a moment where we are receiving so much information, and so much information that has a direct impact on so many of us. So to say that it's gauche to speak about such things feels like just a way to discourage people from being involved in their own political system.
You know, some activist movements garner criticism sometimes for not being intersectional enough. Could you explain to our listeners who may not be familiar with that term, this idea of intersectionality? What does that mean?
You know, I wish there was a term that sounded a little bit less clunky and academic, but really at its core, it's very simple.
Yeah.
Yes. Intersectionality just means acknowledging that we all have multiple identities that intersect to create our life experiences. So I'm a woman, and I can connect with a lot of other women on that, but I'm also a straight woman. I'm also a white woman. And so my experiences of womanhood are not generalizable to everyone. And it's very important to remember that when you're engaging in any kind of activism.
No, you showcase that a bit at the end of your book. You have a section about the people and organizations already doing the work. And there seems to be a wide range here, you know, racial, sexuality, economic, and women's focused organizations, among many others.
Yes, I organized that section to be a resource, a starting point for people that want to get involved and want to focus in on one issue in particular, because I do think it's more manageable that way. And I also included a page in the book where you can write in other organizations that I may have missed, organizations that only exist in your local community, because starting small and starting local is so important.
Let's end it this way. You have inspiring quotes and motivational excerpts from so many people in your book. If you were going to pick just one to share with our listeners as we close the show, what would it be?
You know, Senator Elizabeth Warren says, "If you're not at the table, you're probably on the menu." And I think that's pretty important.
What a great line. That's Emma Gray. Her new book, A Girl's Guide to Joining the Resistance, A Feminist Handbook on Fighting for Good. It was released earlier this week. Emma, thanks so much for taking some time.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was my March 2018 interview with the HuffPost's Emma Gray. On yesterday's program, we discussed a very touchy subject in the metro, panhandling, and a new ordinance the city is considering that would make it harder to do. Find out how at kcur.org/uptodate. You can find us on Twitter. We're at kcuruptodate. Follow me at Steve Kraske, and don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook. Tomorrow we discuss an art series that the city is hoping will become the talk of the town. It's called Open Spaces, and it's going on right now. But do people know about it, and are they showing up? Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, and Kathleen Pointer. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.